So what I want to talk to you about is a little bit different than a lot of the talks have focused on, and that is about the insects as the true working class, the kind of work they do, the vital work, and we often term this as services or ecological services that insects provide. One of the classic examples of an ecological service that was invested in is this, the Catskill Mountains around New York City. The leaders of New York City found that the water quality was rapidly declining, and it was unacceptable. So they looked into several options, one of which was to set up a series of filtration plants, which would have cost billions of dollars, and another was to invest in this conserving this ecosystem of the Catskills, which is what they did, and that did cost millions of dollars, but much less than the billions, and it worked very effectively, and the water quality is now good. So it's just a good example of a little investment in services can pay big dividends. But what services do insects provide? And I've got a list here. It's certainly not an exhaustive list, but it's some of the main ones. And one of those services is pollination. And we've heard a lot about that already today. Certainly some of the most important crops that we grow couldn't be grown without pollinators, and a lot of plants, even those that are not crop plants, are dependent on insects for reproduction. So pollination is an important service. Pest suppression, another underrated service. If you think about the wide variety of species and the vast number of insect species that could be pests, and most of those, by and large, are suppressed by the action of other insects, so predators and parasitoids, keep most of those pests suppressed, and so only a small percentage actually break through and cause economic damage. Decomposition, mostly if you ask people, they would think that microbes do decomposition, and they do the end of decomposition, but studies have shown that decomposition would go like an order of magnitude slower if you didn't have the insects doing the initial shredding of the material. So insects are important for that too. Energy transmission, that's sort of a weird way to put it. Basically what I'm talking about is insects performing a service of being a vital link in the food web or the food chain. And this is what we had to talk about, the insects being extremely important for birds. And they're not just for birds, but for fish, reptiles, mammals, and sort of transferring that energy up the food chain. And then I've got the other seed dispersal, the fact that there's a lot of chemicals and genetics tied up in insects that they're taking care of. And finally, biophilia, what we talked about with the connection between insects and art, also an important service. So at some level, I think everybody can grasp that these services are important and why they're important. But they're not really going to be valued unless we can put a value on those, and I mean a value in terms of dollars. And so in 2006, Mace and I published a paper on how you could estimate the value of the services that insects provide. And so these figures are for the U.S. only, they're in billions of dollars, and they're annual figures. So for pollination, we estimated that only by native pollinators, not by honeybees, but by native pollinators alone, they add $3 billion to the U.S. economy. For biological control, and this is only control of exotic insect pests, we estimated that they add $4.5 billion to the economy. That's dollars that would have to be spent on some other sort of pest control if they weren't there. Decomposition, and this is just decomposition of dung, again going back to the popular dung beetles. We calculate that if dung beetles weren't out there doing their thing, then we would lose, that would be a loss of $500 million a year. And finally, the big one is this idea of food for wildlife, and that if you didn't have insects out there, 96% of the birds would not be able to survive, many of the fish, a lot of the mammals and reptiles. So added all together, that's $57 billion, which I think is pretty impressive. The problem is that even if you have an estimate of the total value, if you don't know the sort of marginal value, it's hard to decide how much of an investment that you should make in conserving those services. And so this is based on a study by Schwartz, and there's two types of there's lots of types of curves you could see, but this shows two basic kind of curves. One is, let's see if I can use this thing. Okay, well, you can see it up there. One is type A, and that's in blue, and it's sort of an incremental model. And what it means is that each time you invest a unit and can conserve a unit of biodiversity, you're getting that same amount of return in terms of the service that the insects provide. And that's a comfortable model to invest in, because you know you're constantly getting this incremental return. On the other hand, if you have type B, then if you start with high biodiversity and you start losing some, at first you don't see any decrease in the services. And so the naysayers will say, well, look, you're losing all this biodiversity, or you're losing maybe this density of service providers, but you haven't lost anything yet. We've still got it all. But then eventually what's going to happen is you're going to slide down the slippery slope and the whole thing is going to sort of fall apart. And almost invariably, we don't know where that slope begins. We don't know where it starts. And what Schwartz found is that, by and large, the way more than half of the studies, the large preponderance, were type B and not type A. And so that makes it a little bit harder to sell this investment in conservation of services. Okay, so, but say you're convinced that by either model that you want to conserve services, and you're thinking about that, and we've already heard a lot of great talks on some of the tools that we can use for conservation, but it turns out that most of the conservation that we think about is for endangered species. Or at least if you're thinking about endangered species, those same tools are probably not going to be effective for the species that provide services. And so I just wanted to put this table up to sort of compare what the sort of species that are endangered versus those that are going to provide services. For endangered species, by definition, they're going to be a single species. For those that provide services, they're almost inevitably a complex, whether that's going to be for suppressing a certain pest or doing some sort of pollination. And usually we don't know which species are in that complex, and we don't know which ones are more important than others. So that sort of hampers our efforts. For endangered species, again, they're very rare. If they weren't very rare, they wouldn't be endangered. For service species, it's almost the opposite end, that somebody quipped once that all politics is local, and it's same is true that all services are local. If you don't have the service-providing species common in your local area, then you don't have that service. And so service species are common, and endangered species tend to be rare. The origin, and this is something that's really interesting and an important difference, and that is that most of our conservation efforts, and I think all of our conservation efforts towards endangered insects has been towards native species. But when you look at the service-providing species, a lot of those are not native. We see a much more mixed composition. And let me just go through this. I'm going to focus mostly on predators because it's something that I know more about. But for service-providing species, if you look at some of the most important groups, you'll see that some of those are largely exotic species. And one of those is carabids, okay, ground-dwelling carabids, staphylinids, rove beetles. This is a good example of a vespid, and this is the one that's an invasive that's taking over large areas. The most earwigs, not thought of as a huge predatory group, but they are predaceous, even though they can be omnivorous too. The most common earwig is the European earwig. And then finally, something that I have been working on are these species of coccinellids, and I say these in quotes because they're actually all the same species, that's just different forms. This is all Harmonia axeritus, okay, and this is the multicolored Asian lady beetle. And this species is quickly becoming the dominant lady beetle in the U.S., okay? And in a sense, that may not be a bad thing, because this is one of the reasons why we see so many of the foreign predators, exotic predators, is that they've been introduced. Most of our crops are from other countries. Most of our pests on those crops are from other countries. And so here we have a crop, soybean, from Asia. We have the aphid. The soybean aphid is from Asia. And then we have an Asian lady beetle. So it seems like a good system. And maybe that means that's something we should try to conserve, is that species that's providing that service. But when you look a little more at this species, you see that it's also doing some things that we wish it didn't do, which means it flies in big numbers in the fall, it gets into people's houses. Some people actually get allergic to that those species when they're inside their walls, and some people complain that they're being bit. I've never been bit by this species, but some people would swear that they have been. So not only that, but they come in big numbers, and they can get on grapes. This is a growing problem in New York, where the Harmonia will get on grapes. They're harvested by the mechanical harvesters. They put off the same smell that makes some people allergic, and that that can disflavor the wine. Okay, so this is the conundrum of service providing species, is that a lot of them are exotic, and sometimes they do things we don't want. Beyond all of these things, one thing that the coccinellids may be doing is they may be forcing out the native species to the point where some of those native coccinellid species may be able to be listed as endangered species. So now we've sort of come full circle. Do we want to really conserve something that's going to be forcing out our native species? Fortunately, we usually don't have to make that decision, because the types of tools that we have to conserve service-providing species are crude enough that we can't separate between helping to save the native or helping to save the exotic species. So just a couple more points on the comparison. Usually the economic impact for finding an endangered species by an individual, and this may not always be the case, but it's often negative, that you have some lost opportunity. For conserving service-providing species, it can be positive. You're getting more pollination. You're getting more pest suppression. Results of inaction: extinction for endangered, and just losing locally and temporarily some resources for the service-providing species. So what I wanted to look at, if you look at public involvement and you go on a continuum between endangered species all the way up to service-providing species, what is public involvement going to be? And I think that, and certainly there's going to be exceptions to this, but mostly when you get down to endangered species, the public involvement is going to be to contribute monetary resources. They're not going to be mostly out in the field trying to save those species. When you get over to the service-providing species, this is something that, like some of the talks we've already had, this is something that people can do literally in their own backyard. So they're going to contribute their own time and maybe some resources. So some of the strategies, and again, we've seen a lot of these today, we can reduce mortality. A big way to do this is thinking about how we do pest control. How can we do pest control without taking out the service-providing species? And one piece of legislation that's out there for this is on almost all pesticide labels, it says on the label to not spray that when there's pollinators in the field. Okay, so there is actually some legal protection, although it doesn't usually specify the pollinators. So not killing them with pesticides is one good way. Providing resources, whether this is through native trees or for pollinators through nesting boxes, is another way that we can do that. So finally, what can the Entomological Society do in terms of thinking about how to conserve service-providing species as opposed to endangered species? One thing that I think we could do as a society a much better job of is advertising the value of these services. If you want to look up the value of insect services, you go to the other ESA page. The Ecological Society has these beautiful web pages on the services that insects provide, and we don't really have that in the ENTSOC, and I think we should. I think we should tout that. I think it can sort of stave off the entomophobia and help develop this entomophilia that we need to lead to conservation. Providing a network for facilitating ideas and exchanging results. We need to know a lot more about what species are actually providing these services and how we can conserve those species. And to do that, we could really synergize by, there's a lot of people out doing studies on this. If we had a network and that's what we're trying to provide, then we might be able to do that. And I encourage you again to sign up in the back. Providing a framework for disseminating practical solutions. So once you have this network and you have researchers out there hopefully finding solutions, how do you get those solutions out there to the public? And I think this again is something that the ESA could help to facilitate. There's pamphlets and booklets, and Xerxes is great about putting some of these out about how you can have pollinator gardens or gardens for predatory insects. And if we could disseminate those through the ESA, I think we could reach a much wider audience. So it would both help the society by promoting this entomophilia, and it would help the people that we want out there conserving these species. Okay, thanks.
Okay. We've got a couple minutes for questions and then we'll move on.
Scott.
Just a maybe slightly nitpicky, but you know, you could contend that endangered species, although costing dollars, it's really the environmental impacts that have caused the endangered species that are
right.
costing those dollars, not the insects themselves, is what I would sort of put forward. I know you have to pay money for endangered species,
right.
but it's really not the
No, I agree, and I think the other thing is it's sort of a for endangered species it's sort of a tragedy of the commons in that that you don't gain much by conserving individual species, but if you don't conserve individual species, then you start losing species, and then we all lose as a whole. But as an individual, I don't think you necessarily gain because those species aren't going to do a service for you. Yeah, that was my point with that. Yeah. So the question is why do we see so many service providing species are non-native and the answer is yes that a lot of those are introduced for the biocontrol agents. All the ones that I showed there essentially are introduced, although it's interesting that some people don't think the Harmonia, the ones that were introduced, were the ones that spread. They think no, that's they just came in on their own. So, yeah, we've introduced a lot of these species, and now they're here, and they're here to control exotic pests. So I would make the argument that by and large, that we should try to conserve those species. Whether, and maybe somebody else can speak to, I don't think there's as many pollinators or...
A few, there are a couple, but not
yeah,
to the same
not to the same extent that there's predators. Dung beetles, on the other hand, I think there are exotic dung beetles, so... There is a lot more of exotic species that make up the service providers than the endangered ones.